of Adam. Mitchell is right. The analogy between Christianity and the Church of Diversity is so strong that it's evident that wokeness plays a religious role in one's life, and therefore really is a religion for legal purposes. Under the woke worldview, being born white, straight, male, or worse, all three, is an original sin that one must spend their life atoning for. Just as Catholics think we inherited the sins of Adam and Eve, even if we've done nothing wrong, disciples of wokeness think we've inherited the sins of the founding fathers. The mechanism for group guilt is just called systemic racism instead of original sin. And as I pointed out earlier, the woke left punishes its heretics with the same fervor as any Inquisition and for the same reasons. Even more important than bringing infidels to the light is keeping the faithful on the straight and narrow path. Any deviation from orthodoxy must be punished. That's a key part of why wokeness really does play a religious role in one's life. It's a system of beliefs that stands as one indivisible unit and touches on all aspects of one's existence. You aren't allowed to consider the evidence and pick and choose which parts of wokeness you like. If you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. Just like Christianity or Islam, wokeness purports to provide a system of beliefs that explains everything, and it doesn't allow its believers to pick and choose which of its explanations they like. Wokeness counts as a religion for the EEOC's purposes because, like other religions, it provides unified, systematic explanations that order one's entire life. And like other religions, wokeness gives commands, not suggestions. And its disciples are expected to obey all of its commands, not just the ones that make sense to them. You're not allowed to be a little woke, just like Christians can't follow their favorite five commandments. You have to embrace the whole LGBTQ acronym. Feminism too, but not the trans-exclusionary kind. And the acronyms that function as lists of commandments keep growing. Last time I checked, it had become something like LGBTTQQIAAP. There's a new acronym making its way around, BIPOC, for Black Indigenous People of Color. It used to just be people of color. BIPOC is all the rage in universities these days, which means it's a year away from being fashionable in corporate boardrooms. The point of the updated acronym is to de-emphasize Asian Americans in the list of identities that matter. The high priests of diversity decided Asians were privileged, or white adjacent, so they updated their acronym commandments to demote us. It's not a religion I subscribe to, but wokeness really is a religion. It does meet the EEOC's two-part definition because its adherents cling to it fervently, and it dictates all their thoughts and deeds. Wokeness touches every part of its disciples' lives. Like any other religion, being woke isn't supposed to be a narrow one-off commitment. It's supposed to be a way of life. It gives its believers purpose and meaning. It's the structure that they use to make sense of the universe. Where a non-woke person sees ordinary interactions, for instance, a disciple of wokeness sees microaggressions. Just as a Christian sees God's hand in all of creation, someone who's woke sees the guiding hand of identity-based power relations everywhere they look. Being a religion comes with legal costs and benefits. My analysis implies that an employee should be legally protected for expressing woke beliefs outside work and have those beliefs accommodated at it, just like any other religious beliefs. But it also implies that woke employers can't punish their employees for refusing to worship at the same church. So businesses can't punish woke employees for saying that Black Lives Matter, but woke companies can't punish employees for saying that all lives matter. It's a simple legal insight with implications that stretch from Silicon Valley to Wall Street. Today, many employees, perhaps many of you, face the choice between being able to keep their job to put food on the table or being able to speak their mind freely. It's a Hobson's choice. That's not our country, but a distortion of it. In America, we don't force you to choose between the American dream and free speech. You get to enjoy both at once. This chapter offers legal proof for that basic idea. James Damore can't legally be fired for sharing his views on gender disparities. Emmanuel Cafferty can't be fired for accidentally making an OK sign with his hands. Huntington Ingalls can't fire one of its shipyard workers for wearing a Trump hat. And you can't be fired for refusing to attend the diversity and inclusion seminar hosted by Robin DiAngelo in the company auditorium. If your boss gives you a hard time, tell him you'll see him in court and that you'll be sending the company your legal bills too. Who knows? They might even cost as much as DiAngelo's speaking fees. Chapter 12. Critical Diversity Theory. I learned a valuable lesson from former Harvard president Larry Summers. I didn't learn it from him personally, but I picked it up as I watched his fall from grace while I was a student there back in 2007. The lesson was that there are certain things you just can't say, even at a liberal arts university in a democratic society. In my senior year, Summers was forced to step down as the university's president for comments that he made at a conference about diversity in the science and engineering workforce. He warned that his comments were intended to be an attempt at provocation. He offered three hypotheses for the higher proportion of men in high-end science and engineering positions. One hypothesis was that men were more drawn than women to those jobs. Another was that hires discriminated against women. And Summers' third hypothesis was that there was greater variability among men in some cognitive abilities relevant to science and engineering. Summers observed that for certain math tests, there were higher standard deviations in test scores for boys than for girls. That means that the students who performed best and worst on these tests were usually boys. His attempt at provocation succeeded, and I understand why some women at Harvard were annoyed by his comments. But the firestorm that followed was wildly disproportionate to what he actually said. His speech became the scandal of a generation for the university. After taking a thorough drubbing in the press, Summers, one-time U.S. Treasury Secretary, among the youngest tenured professors in Harvard's history, and a respected university leader, was forced to resign as Harvard's president. I was selected to be one of the three students on the advisory committee to choose his replacement. It quickly became clear that the committee's mandate was to appoint a woman to make up for Summers' cardinal sin. And that's exactly what we did, even though no one publicly identified that as our objective. Harvard's motto is Veritas, but very little about what happened that year felt like the pursuit of truth. It was a shame to me that Larry Summers was punished for asking an important question that others ignored. For example, the International Chess Federation, which organizes separate championships for men and women without saying a peep about why. The lesson was clear. Extol free speech publicly, but keep controversial thoughts to yourself. Got it. As the years passed, I realized what I'd witnessed back in 2007 was neither the beginning nor end of wokeness, but an important point in the middle of its story, the point where it became dominant. When wokeness struck down the president of Harvard, it raised its flag triumphantly over all of academia. Race and gender studies had been laying down roots for decades, but they really started flourishing around that time. So-called critical theories sprouted like weeds. Racism was redefined. The critical race theory experts had discovered that it was definitionally impossible to be racist toward white people. Their students dutifully spread that epiphany to the rest of society. Intersectionality became the word of the day, and then the decade, even though no one understood exactly what it meant, an ideal feature for any concept to evade falsifiability. A few academics fought the rising tide. In what has been dubbed the Grievance Studies Affair, a trio of liberal academics, Helen Pluckrose, Peter Boghossian, and James Lindsay, successfully published several purposefully farcical academic papers in peer-reviewed journals in fields like cultural studies, queer studies, fat studies, race and gender studies, and so on. Among the highlights were an article using observations from dog parks to prove that dogs engaged in rape culture, one arguing that men could reduce transphobia by anally penetrating themselves with sex toys, and a version of Mein Kampf rewritten in feminist jargon. The trio had many similar articles under review. The hoax only stopped after journalists at the Wall Street Journal uncovered it. Deprived of their hoax, Pluckrose and Lindsay published a book called Cynical Theories, that revealed the intellectual bankruptcy of academia's love affair with identity politics. The Grievance Studies affair was the proud inheritor of a tradition begun by Alan Sokal's famous hoax back in 1996. Concerned that academia was beginning to publish anything that used fancy language and scientific theories to support its liberal conclusions, Sokal published an article titled "Transgressing the Boundaries Toward a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity" in the postmodern journal Social Text. Sokal used a bunch of scientific gibberish to argue that quantum gravity, a subfield of physics that uses quantum mechanics to describe gravity, had progressive political implications. Sokal's article contained gems, like the claim that science cannot assert a privileged epistemological status with respect to counter-hegemonic narratives emanating from dissident or marginalized communities. Funnily enough, you can find the exact same proclamations in the work of liberal favorites like Robin DiAngelo 2 decades later, but now they're made unironically and accepted as gospel. People like Sokal, Pluckrose, Boghossian, and Lindsay fought the good fight, but the odds were always against them. They now find themselves pariahs on the outskirts of academia. Portland State University, where Boghossian works as a philosophy professor, instituted a research misconduct inquiry against him over the Grievance Studies affair. It ruled that he had violated ethical guidelines on research involving human subjects. He is now banned from doing further research. Pluckrose and Lindsay have no academic positions. Pluckrose's biography in Cynical Theories vaguely refers to her as an exile from the humanities. Pluckrose is far from alone in her exile. Conservatives have long been unofficially banned from academia, outside of a few enclaves like Notre Dame and the University of Chicago. Now centrists and liberals who don't agree with the new identity politics paradigm are being purged too. The ideological cleansing extends to administrative staff, not just teachers. For instance, Jody Shaw, a liberal divorced mother of two, just resigned from her job as a student support coordinator at Smith College, her alma mater, after a years-long struggle against its racially hostile environment. Smith had heavily emphasized racial sensitivity training after a black student complained that some staff members had racially profiled her. It made no difference that the law firm Smith hired to investigate her claims concluded they were false. Jody Shaw's trouble began when the library orientation program she'd been preparing for months was axed at the last minute because she was going to rap, and white women were forbidden from rapping at the newly sensitive version of Smith. And then because Shaw lacked a prepared program, she wasn't able to get the promotion she'd been up for and had to accept a lower-paying job. In her new position, she was often told that her job required her to discuss her thoughts and feelings about her whiteness, and that any refusal to discuss her white privilege was a case of white fragility. By the end of her time at Smith, even Shaw's polite refusals to speak about her race were dubbed acts of racial aggression. She went public with her story and then chose to resign from Smith instead of accepting hush money from the college. There are millions of stories like Shaw's, unfortunately. What makes her story special is that she's willing to tell it and willing to accept unemployment in a pandemic rather than bowing to the woke regime. A recent report from the Center of the Study of Partisanship and Ideology found that over a third of conservative academics and PhD students in the U.S. have been threatened with disciplinary action for their views, and 70% of conservative academics report a hostile departmental climate for their beliefs. The report contains a number of other grim statistical findings, like the fact that more than 40% of U.S. academics would refuse to hire a Trump supporter. The church of diversity waxes strong. All must be cleansed. All must be saved. The war for academia has already been lost. When Identity Politics took down Larry Summers in 2007, it was a sign that wokeness had won at the highest levels, and it was time to begin the mop-up action. Now, having won everything they can win in universities, Grievance Studies and Critical Theories are turning to new battlegrounds: corporations and governments. And they do it all under the banner of diversity. Institutions including companies, nonprofits, and government agencies are increasingly adopting implicit and explicit approaches to foster greater diversity in their ranks. In principle, this is a good thing. Diversity of thought improves the quality of decisions in most organizations. However, in recent years, many organizations have resorted exclusively to using genetic characteristics as a proxy for diversity of thought, relying on metrics such as race and gender as the exclusive barometers for measuring diversity in the leadership of an organization. This approach is flawed on multiple levels. First, when institutions conflate racial and gender diversity metrics with diversity of thought in their organizations, they implicitly reinforce the incorrect assumption that genetic characteristics predict something important about the way that a person thinks, the most fundamental assumption underlying racism itself. Second, this approach empowers entrenched managers to create the visible appearance of diversity in their organization while avoiding the need to engage with true diversity of thought, including challenges to their own incumbency. Third, when a narrow conception of diversity is implemented through affirmative action or other quota-based systems, that fuels racism and sexism by fostering tokenism in the workplace and animus among communities that fail to benefit from those same programs. Notwithstanding these flaws, institutions are relying increasingly on racial and gender-related characteristics as the exclusive basis for measuring and implementing diversity in their organizations. Today, leaders who fail to adopt this narrow approach are publicly vilified. However, these same leaders have also failed to offer alternative ways to measure and implement true diversity of thought in their organizations. I propose a new movement to resist the enforcement of race and gender-based diversity metrics across institutions by offering a new vision for achieving true diversity of thought in any organization. This new movement aims to more effectively achieve three essential objectives. First, define what types of diversity of thought are important to an organization. Second, measure diversity of thought in an organization. And third, select for diversity of thought when hiring leaders to scale an organization. I call this critical diversity theory, or CDT, to reflect its critical perspectives on the prevailing narrative of racial and gender diversity in response to intellectual movements such as critical race theory and critical feminist theory, which spawned this narrow conception of diversity. Critical theory refers to an approach of inquiry that reveals and challenges power structures. CDT, or critical diversity theory, should follow this tradition by challenging the new power structure created by critical race and gender theory itself, one that has weaponized a narrow conception of diversity to implement a monolithic social agenda that is increasingly intolerant of dissent and agnostic to the institutional purpose of an organization. CDT challenges this new power structure in a simple way. The first fundamental premise of CDT is that different organizations ought to approach diversity of thought in different ways, depending on their institutional purpose. That is, by taking diverse approaches to the question of diversity itself. The second fundamental premise of CDT is that the most effective way to achieve diversity of thought in an organization is to screen candidates for the diversity of their thoughts. That the most effective way to achieve diversity of experience is to screen candidates for the diversity of their experiences. And that the most effective way to measure diversity of thought or experience in an organization is to measure the diversity of thoughts or experiences in that organization, without regard to genetically inherited characteristics like race and gender. CDT must become an interdisciplinary movement to succeed. As a starting point, this new movement will require leaders of companies, nonprofits, and government institutions to work together to create new methods of measuring and implementing true diversity of thought in their organizations. I propose a multidisciplinary collaboration between leaders of these organizations, working in conjunction with academic counterparts, to develop measurable tools that any organization can implement to assess and advance diversity of thought in a way that is best suited to its own organizational purpose. This will not be an easy undertaking. One reason that race and gender have become the predominant metrics for diversity is that they are simple to measure and implement. By contrast, true diversity of thought is difficult to achieve, especially when coupled with an organization's need for employees to align around its goals. A well-run organization requires not only diversity of thought, but also an unwavering commitment to its mission and principles. These goals are necessarily in tension with one another, at least in some measure. For example, one of Roivant's business principles is be contrarian, that is, challenge conventional wisdom when necessary. It's impossible to create an environment where people challenge conventional wisdom if everyone thinks in the same way. So we value diversity in the ways people think. Some who craft arguments, some who are expert at interpreting data, and so on. That's one form of diversity of thought. But another of our business principles is to climb the wall. That is to work hard to overcome obstacles. We don't want diverse attitudes with respect to their willingness to do that. Our main goal as a company is to develop medicines faster for patients who need them. We don't want diversity in our employees' commitments toward that goal. And that's something that everyone at Roivant should be equally committed to. Applauding diversity ad nauseum is easy, but defining what types of diversity each organization should desire is much more important. That's what CDT is all about. It forces institutions to define their true purpose. This new movement requires leaders of organizations to openly acknowledge the areas in which they seek diversity of thought, while also defining the areas in which they prioritize organizational alignment over diversity of opinions. These are fundamental questions for any organization to answer. Diversity of thought is important, but only insofar as it helps an institution realize its true purpose. Skin-deep diversity metrics like race and gender often subvert true institutional purpose in a woke world by supplanting that purpose with the activist goals espoused by critical race and critical gender theorists. By contrast, CDT invites leaders of organizations to actually use diversity, in particular diversity of thought, to define the true essence of an organization by defining the areas in which diversity of thought is desirable and the areas in which it is not. The answers to these questions will inevitably vary across organizations, and that's good. These are the very differences that allow one institution to distinguish its purpose from that of another. Institutional pluralism is at the heart of American pluralism. Universities educate students. Pharma companies make medicines for patients. Banks lend money to borrowers. Charities help people in need. Museums memorialize history. Orchestras perform music. Congress makes laws. They don't all do the same thing, and we shouldn't want them to. That we have so many different institutions with distinct purposes is part of what makes our society vibrant. That's true diversity. Regardless of our attitude toward woke values, whether we love them or not, we should be dubious of dissolving true institutional diversity in favor of any homogeneous social agenda, even if that agenda masquerades in the name of diversity itself. Here are five key principles that can serve as the foundation of this new critical diversity theory movement across our institutions. These principles are simple, not complicated, but implementing them will be hard, not easy. Excellence, opportunity, and civility. An alternative to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Number one, excellence first. Diversity is not an end in itself, but a means toward achieving excellence. Two, institutional purpose. Institutions should define their own unique purpose and define what kinds of diversity they seek and do not seek in order to pursue their purpose. Three, institutional pluralism. Nonprofit institutions may have conflicting perspectives on important social questions. That's a good thing. Institutional pluralism is part of American pluralism. Four, separation of corporation and state. For-profit companies should focus exclusively on making products and providing services for profit, not on advancing unrelated social or political agendas. Five, end discrimination. The best way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. The same goes for gender and other inherited attributes. My graduation from Harvard in 2007 was a memorable one. I had the opportunity to see Bill Gates himself in the flesh at my graduation. I sat in the front row and shook his hand on stage. Yet even today, I distinctly remember my disappointment in his speech at the time. It wasn't a bad speech. It just felt like the entire thing was about delivering an epilogue to the real story. He focused on the importance of giving back, but never really talked about how one goes about generating the things that one later gives back. That was the part I was most interested in learning from him that day, but I never did. His most memorable line of the speech, the one that stuck with me, was this: "Humanity's greatest advances are not in its discoveries, but in how those discoveries are applied to reduce inequity." He concluded his speech by calling the students in the audience to action. Be activists. Take on the big inequities. It will be one of the great experiences of your lives. You graduates are coming of age in an amazing time. As you leave Harvard, you have technology that members of my class never had. You have awareness of global inequity, which we did not have. And with that awareness, you likely also have an informed conscience that will torment you if you abandon these people whose lives you could change with very little effort. You have more than we had. You must start sooner and carry on longer. Knowing what you know, how could you not? As I listened to Gates, I looked on stage and saw Drew Gilpin Faust, the new president of the university, who had just replaced Larry Summers after he had been forced to resign for his now infamous remarks. Despite being a student representative on the committee that selected her, I really had no idea how President Faust would actually lead the university. All I knew is that she was the first female president of Harvard, and that's what mattered most in the spring of 2007. Things changed at Harvard after President Summers' departure. Under President Faust, in 2016, the university decided to change the title of certain academic posts that included the word master to faculty dean instead, in response to protests from students who claimed the title had echoes of slavery. The actual etymological root of the word was magister, Latin for teacher, but Harvard made the name change anyway. A few years later, the university launched the Committee to Articulate Principles on Renaming, a 16-person body to explore the renaming of campus buildings, spaces, programs, professorships, and other objects in view of their association with historical figures whose advocacy or support of activities would today be found abhorrent by members of the Harvard community. Along the way, Harvard would banish the sinners too, notably in 2019, when the university pressured one of its law professors to step down as a faculty dean for serving as legal defense counsel to Harvey Weinstein. I found it curious that Harvardians who vehemently advocated for the right to legal counsel for alleged terrorists in Guantanamo, which I too personally support, weren't also vocal about defending the same principle for Harvey Weinstein. It was fitting that my commencement ceremony would prepare me for a decade ahead in a new world that looked very different from the one I knew as a kid in Ohio. In retrospect, I witnessed the dawn of modern wokeism on display at graduation that day, a new culture that would soon spread across the country like a wildfire and eventually reach Ohio too. We were entering a new era obsessed with empowering those whom we label as disempowered. Large corporations and universities goaded those same people to self-identify as disempowered too, leaving those very corporations and universities more empowered than ever. It was the beginning of a long saga of sorting and then resorting ourselves into groups, of signifying our tribes to one another through the trivial things that we say and wear. In this brave new era, the sinners of past epochs would face a stark choice: either self-flagellate on stage like Bill Gates, or disappear like Larry Summers. Chapter 13. Woke Consumerism and the Big Sort. Now, wokeness has graduated from college and entered the corporate world. Modern corporations seize every opportunity to signal their virtuous identities to us, so that as their customers, we can signal our own. This mercenary corporate virtue signaling was vividly on display after George Floyd was killed, when even fast food companies fell all over themselves to align with the Black Lives Matter movement. Pepsi had pioneered the effort to profit off the BLM movement years earlier with a commercial featuring Kendall Jenner abandoning a photo shoot to solve police brutality by offering soda to a cop. But this early effort to make money off BLM was too crude. This time, corporations knew celebrities would not be enough. The situation called for socially conscious tweets. Popeye's Twitter account was one of the first to throw its weight behind the cause, tweeting, "We are nothing without black lives. There's no room for injustice. We commit to strengthening every facet of our culture and policies to foster an environment where equality for black people is a priority. We'll use our platform to support this movement. Hashtag Black Lives Matter." Not to be outdone, a day later, Wendy's Twitter account chimed in with, "Our voice would be nothing without black culture. Right now, a lot of people are hurting because of blatant racism against black people. Their voices need to be heard. Period. Hashtag Black Lives Matter." The commitment was short-lived. Wendy's lost its voice a week later when Rayshard Brooks was killed outside one of its drive-thrus. It wasn't really Wendy's fault, but it decided to lie low just to be safe. Its Twitter account stayed silent for 3 weeks, resurfacing mainly to strenuously deny rumors that Wendy's had donated money to Donald Trump. It had leapt to associate itself with BLM at first, but the moment the association threatened its image, it shifted with the winds of profit. In the fight for justice, for-profit corporations make fickle friends. Wokeness doomed itself when it became so mainstream that companies realized they could make money off it. Watching Wendy's Twitter account try to one-up Popeyes in social awareness is like hearing Hillary Clinton say, "Pokemon, go to the polls." Both are signs that a trend has become too popular for its own good. There's something disingenuous about it, something condescending. Whenever this pandering occurs, whether it comes from politicians or corporations, you just know that some slick PR guys brainstormed it during a business lunch and then sat back and said they'll eat this shit up. They usually high-five each other afterward. Make no mistake, that's what State Street was really thinking when it commissioned Fearless Girl. And it's what Goldman Sachs is really thinking when it institutes a boardroom diversity quota. They'll eat this shit up. Part of what I'm saying is that bankers should shut up and bank. But I'm also making a broader point about America. At this point, anyone could see that something in this nation is broken. Maybe everyone sees it. We all want justice. We just disagree about what it is. We crave justice. But all Wendy's really has to offer is burgers. So it artificially ties the two together. Corporations have started feeding us aphorisms about equality, because they know we hunger for more substantial fare. Woke CEOs and investors trick consumers with the illusion that by engaging in normal acts of consumption, we're fulfilling our social obligations. They tell us that by giving our money to the right companies, conveniently their companies, we're making the world a better place. Maybe the idea is that it's strictly better to give our money to socially responsible companies than their near identical competitors. But we'd be strictly better off if companies and their customers ended the shared fiction that every capitalist transaction must also be part of some grand fight between good and evil. I was once at a New Year's party where a guy spent 5 minutes telling me how his handmade silk shirt was some kind of symbolic protest against the colonialism of the Dutch East India Company. All I remember is that I wasn't convinced that he was doing as much good as he thought he was. He probably would have done more for the causes he cared about by giving the money to the first person who asked for it. But then, he wouldn't have the silk shirt. Some company fed him some story about how he could make the world better by buying material things, and he eagerly ate it up. Whatever justice is, surely it can't be attained so incidentally by just picking the right shirts, the right burgers, the right bankers. You can't get the things you want anyway and order some equality on the side. Sometimes a shirt is just a shirt. By making it part of some grand narrative about colonialism, corporations are appealing to our desire to be part of something greater than ourselves. Of course, brands have always tried to dress up ordinary goods and services as part of a lifestyle, part of an identity. But what's new is this widespread effort to convince consumers that buying these ordinary things is noble and virtuous. Corporations used to try to convince you that buying their stuff would make you cool. Now they tell you that buying it will make you good. The difference is subtle but important. What's cool is entirely subjective, but what's good is not. There's no real risk to letting the slick PR people define what's cool, but there's a lot of risk to letting them define what's good. When I was young, it was cool to be rebellious, to act like you didn't care about anything. Now, it's cool to be woke and act like you care about everything. So the stores in the mall that outfitted us as rebels when we were young dress us up like good people now that we're older. By now, we all know that woke shirts and woke tweets are often forms of virtue signaling. But this obvious problem masks a more insidious one. Corporate wokeness, and much of wokeness in general, is fundamentally about identity signaling. The main agenda for both Wendy's and Popeyes wasn't actually to send people the message that they were good. It was to send certain people the message that they were members of the same tribe. And by establishing membership in the tribe of their target consumers, they automatically established themselves as good. The two weren't actually trying to one-up each other at all, which explains why their statements were nearly identical. The true corporate competition was not between Wendy's and Popeyes, but between those two and Chick-fil-A, which had become a favorite target of liberal boycotts ever since it donated to religious organizations that opposed gay marriage. The tweets that Wendy's and Popeyes posted about BLM were obviously shallow, but shallow tweets are enough to sell a tribal association. If you want a fast food chicken sandwich, you have to choose whether to open up a bag from Chick-fil-A in front of your friends or one from a chain that belongs to your tribe. You don't make the choice based on which sandwich tastes better. How did we come to this farcical point where your politics chooses your sandwiches and your sandwich makers must choose their politics? I'm tempted to say that nothing is sacred anymore. But America's problem is actually the opposite. Nothing is allowed to be ordinary anymore. Partisanship now infects everything and attaches sanctity to even the most mundane consumer decisions. In the American search for identity, to give our lives meaning, we make the ordinary sacred. The way we use ordinary things to signal our tribal identities has dangerous consequences for our democracy. One of them is that this rampant identity signaling has made it easier for us to unconsciously segregate ourselves. Journalist Bill Bishop documented this new informal segregation in his 2004 book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. He points out that as Americans have gained more economic freedom and technology has made travel easier over the decades, we've been more able than ever to move where we want to. He argues that when we choose a neighborhood, we choose it based on a lot of little factors that make it just feel right. Things like whether there are parks, what kind of churches are around, whether you see neighbors walking their dogs and washing their trucks, whether there's a Starbucks on the corner, whether there's a Chick-fil-A nearby. It turns out that all these little factors that make a place feel right map onto partisan associations. It feels right to live among neighbors who share your values and beliefs. And so over the last few decades, Americans have sorted themselves into red neighborhoods and blue ones. Bishop documents this self-sorting by examining the percentage of voters who live in landslide counties during competitive presidential elections, counties where one party won by 20 percentage points or more. He found that the one point since World War II, when Americans were most likely to live side by side with people who supported another political party, was in 1976, at the time of the election between Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. At that time, during a close contest, only 26% of Americans lived in counties where the vote was a landslide. Americans drifted apart over the next few decades. By 1992, during another competitive election, about 38% of Americans lived in landslide counties. And after that, like-minded Americans just kept flocking together. By the time Bishop was writing in 2004, in one of the closest presidential contests in history, 48.3% of all voters lived in communities where the election wasn't close at all. David Wasserman, U.S. House editor and senior election analyst for the Cook Political Report, investigated whether Bishop's thesis about the Big Sort has held up over the years and found that things have actually gotten even worse. By the time of the hard-fought 2016 election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, a whopping 61% of American voters lived in counties that had voted for one of the two by a 20-point margin or more. Wasserman concluded that purple America has all but disappeared. It's all red and blue now. The bottom line regarding these stats? 40 years ago, it was completely normal to live alongside people who had different politics than you. But today it's strange. The country has been slowly but surely brought to a boil in a partisan pot. As we've gradually become more aware of our differences, we've increasingly chosen to surround ourselves with people who think the same way as us. Corporate wokeness is an important enabler of this self-segregation because the things we buy dictate the places we go. They also determine whom we interact with once we get there. The things we buy and the merchants we buy those things from now signal which side we're on. We don't just segregate ourselves geographically. The Big Sort has gone online, too. Social media companies promised to bring people together, but instead they provide echo chambers where like-minded people reinforce each other's biases. Technology has made it easier than ever for us to travel where we want and to talk to whom we want. But it turns out what most of us wanted was to reaffirm our beliefs. Back in 2004, Bishop noticed that we'd been sorting ourselves in physical space, and in the time since, we've done the same thing in cyberspace. In 2020, when I joined Parler, the alternative social media site that became popular for its commitment to free speech in the wake of Silicon Valley's coordinated censorship crusade, I posted something that was critical of woke capitalism. One of the first responses I got was, "Shut the fuck up, you fucking foreigner." Meanwhile, Twitter was no better. Users who self-identify as progressives routinely comment, "Shut up, you right-wing Patel," in response to my tweets. My far-right friends gravitate to Parler. My liberal friends view Parler as untouchable and flock to Twitter. In reality, they're both just echo chambers designed to allow different tribes to vent their frustrations. The online sort only accelerates the Big Sort in the real world, too. When corporations take sides in Americans' partisan culture war, they're not just signaling their tribe, they're selling you an easy way to signal yours. This kind of corporate wokeness can seem superficial, and it is, but there's something deviously sophisticated at its core. The clothes we wear, the food we eat, and the businesses we shop at have become our uniforms and weapons in America's tribal feud. If you're a liberal who likes coffee, you get it at Starbucks. If you're a conservative, maybe you buy it from Black Rifle Coffee Company, which exists mostly to sell coffee to conservatives who hate Starbucks. It claims that if you love America, you ought to love its coffee, which sports names like Freedom Fuel, but probably just tastes like coffee. The taste was never really the point. Corporations are arming us with symbols that let us identify friends and foes so that we can sort ourselves to make us better consumers. History is littered with examples of young soldiers who fire someone else's gun from their shoulders. Today, capitalists are the gunsmiths of our culture war. Our increasing use of ordinary goods to identify our tribal friends is just one side of the new trend of woke consumerism. It also demands that its disciples boycott those goods to punish political foes. Consumers commit a grave moral error when they give in to that demand. Money and morality weren't meant to mix. Even refried beans have become weapons in the culture war. The growing trend of using companies as proxies to signal political identity was exemplified by the battle over Goya Foods, the largest Hispanic-owned food company in the U.S. Goya got into trouble when its CEO, Robert Unanue, praised President Trump while attending a White House ceremony rolling out the administration's Hispanic Prosperity Initiative. Overnight, whether you ate Goya products or not was inseparably tied to whether you supported Trump. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez rallied the progressive troops by tweeting, "Oh, look, it's the sound of me Googling how to make your own adobo." Thousands of liberals joined her, posting pictures and videos of them banishing Goya from their pantries. On the other side, Ivanka Trump and President Trump himself both posted pictures smiling in front of Goya products. "If it's Goya, it has to be good," Ivanka wrote, parroting the company's motto as she proudly displayed a can of black beans. Not to be outdone, President Trump tweeted a picture of himself, giving a toothy grin and two thumbs up to a spread of Goya products laid out on his desk in the Oval Office. The president was partial to the chocolate wafers. Thousands of conservatives dutifully posted pictures of themselves stuffing shopping carts with Goya. It's quickly becoming a given that boycotts are the first tool consumers will reach for to object to political statements they dislike. Witness, for instance, the fledgling boycott of Purdue chicken. When Senator David Perdue deliberately mispronounced Kamala Harris's name, the hashtag #BoycottPurdueChicken immediately flooded Twitter. The problem? There was no actual connection between the Perdue who served in the Senate and the Perdue who founded the chicken company. After Purdue chicken kept desperately pleading this fact, that boycott died a quiet death. But it confirmed the new woke policy. Boycott first, ask questions later. In early 2021, activists in Georgia took this policy to its natural next step when they boycotted Coca-Cola, Delta Airlines, Home Depot, and UPS for the great sin of not condemning Georgia's new voting law loudly enough. Although vilified as the new Jim Crow over provisions like criminalizing gifts of food and drink to voters and banning mobile voting sites, the law was in truth a mixed bag. It also expanded early voting opportunities and guaranteed a minimum number of drop boxes for ballots. The activists justified the boycotts by saying all these companies issued statements supporting BLM and were failing to follow through on them by being silent about Georgia's new voting law. So it's a combo move. First, the activists pressure companies to issue seemingly symbolic corporate platitudes in support of BLM, saying it's the least they could do. Then they call for boycotts when those corporations don't side with substantive political policies. Get companies to give an inch, then take a mile. Protesters staged a die-in at the Coca-Cola Museum in Atlanta and called for a boycott of Coke, while others gathered at the Delta terminal in Atlanta Airport, demanding that CEO Ed Bastian kill the bill. The new group, Black Voters Matter, declared, "If you can't get involved in the business of fighting for democracy, then we're going to have to get involved in your business." The strategy worked like a charm. After holding out for a week, Coca-Cola and Delta folded and denounced Georgia's new law. Major League Baseball then took the unprecedented step of moving its widely anticipated All-Star game out of Atlanta to Colorado instead, as a way of protesting Georgia's new voting law. Ironically, in a year where the game was supposed to honor Hank Aaron, the famed black baseball star who played for Atlanta. Companies from American Express to PayPal to T. Rowe Price weighed in as well. Now scarcely a week goes by without a new corporate political declaration. Conservatives like me will say that this corporate politicking is just Citizens United on steroids, and that liberals are hypocritical for rallying around the cry that corporations aren't people, only to demand that corporations behave more like people. Liberals will say that Coca-Cola's Georgia stand is just Citizens United applied consistently, and that we conservatives are hypocrites for embracing mixing politics with business and Citizens United, and then condemning it when companies take stands against Georgia's voting law. As a moral matter, I don't like corporations influencing politics at all, whether through election spending or lobbying over voting laws. As a constitutional matter, I begrudgingly accept that both forms of corporate influence are legal. I'm also a bit more worried about Georgia-style lobbying than Citizens United because of an important asymmetry between the two. Coca-Cola doesn't stifle its employees' votes when it spends money on an election because people cast their votes privately. But when Coca-Cola announces an official corporate position against Georgia's voting law, that makes it more difficult for its employees to speak in favor of the law publicly without fear of retribution that might put their job security or upward economic mobility at risk. When corporate speech chills citizens' speech, that threatens democracy even more than when corporations simply write checks to political campaigns. In Chapter 1, I talked about how corporations hide behind woke causes to disguise their greed and accumulate power. In Chapter 4, I focused on the inverse problem of woke executives, showing how America's rising managerial class uses the pretense of serving stakeholders to escape accountability and accrete power. Collectively, these represent examples of woke capitalism, a top-down phenomenon driven by elites who control capital and occupy seats of corporate power. By contrast, woke consumerism, consumer boycotts, buying sprees, and related identity signaling isn't a top-down problem driven by CEOs and influential investors. It comes from consumers themselves. This particular threat to democracy comes from within. But once corporations discover the grassroots approach, they're quick to piggyback on it and turn it to their ends. Witness Yelp's recent decision to encourage reviewers to tag restaurants they consider racist. Yelp noticed that a lot of its users were warning people about racist behavior at businesses, and it decided to give them an official platform to make organizing boycotts even easier. This was either a virtuous or a vicious cycle, depending on how woke you are. The change started with woke consumers wanting to boycott, and then alert woke executives changed their business model to encourage the boycotts. This allows more woke consumers to vote with their dollars, placing more pressure on businesses to conform to woke values, whether they want to or not. No matter what a CEO actually thinks, most of them will do anything to avoid being branded with the scarlet letter of racism. Best to tweet in support of Black Lives Matter and fire any employee who's even accused of racism. The moral of the Yelp story is this: once woke consumerism sparks a protest, woke capitalism can pour gasoline on it. Using boycotts and buying sprees to mix capitalism and politics is harmful when it's always the first tool people reach for. But the impulse is actually the natural, inevitable, and understandable consequence of capitalism. If you think your barber's racist and you can't stand them, you go to a different one. You warn your friends not to go to the racist barber, and you tell them about the cool new one you found. It's built into the fabric of capitalism that consumers will choose whom to give business to based in part on whether they share social values. It's part of what allowed capitalism to tear down the caste system in India, for example. But woke consumerism takes this too far. It's one thing for me to decide a barber's racist, go to a different one, and tell my friends about it. It's another if I don't even need a haircut, I hear about a racist barber in another city, and I drive over to stand outside his shop with a bullhorn, yelling at everyone not to go in. You can choose your barber based on whether you like his views on race or whether you like his wallpaper. But consumers start to cross a moral line when they move beyond making their own decisions and start making everyone else's. When I stand outside the barbershop with a bullhorn yelling about his racism, I'm not making my own decision about where to get my haircut. I'm trying to starve the barber. Wealth is a bullhorn. That's one of the biggest problems with woke consumerism. Playing politics through consumer boycotts is a rich man's game. The more money you have, the more impact your boycott has. In capitalism, each dollar is like a vote. It's perfectly fine for dollars to vote on which goods and services rise to the top. The capitalist principle of dollars being votes is embodied, for example, in the ways companies select members of their boards of directors. Shareholders elect the board of directors, but it's not that each shareholder has an equal voice. Each share has equal weight. So the people who own the most shares have the biggest say. Since shares can straightforwardly be translated into dollars, dollars literally buy votes in the corporate context. And there's nothing wrong with that. In the marketplace of goods and services, $1, one vote is appropriate. But the marketplace of ideas is supposed to follow the principle of one person, one vote. That's how we aggregate votes in a democracy. When we normalize using dollars to win battles over ideas, we're just handing the wealthy control over society's values. It's not that the rich are the only ones who get to play the game. In reality, many poorer Americans often participate in consumer boycotts too. But the cost of participation is higher for those with less money. Using your buying power to signal your morality is a sort of luxury that implicitly costs more by mandating what you can buy and what you can't. To the extent that woke consumerism imposes a cost on consumers, it's one that's disproportionately borne by those who can least afford to bear it. In theory, there are some potential advantages to having a market in votes where they can be bought and sold. The biggest one is that one person, one vote doesn't allow voting results to reflect the intensity of voter preferences. A slight majority that has a weak preference for an outcome can overrule a sizable minority that strongly opposes it. In a vacuum, bringing dollars into the equation and letting people buy and sell votes to each other would allow votes to reflect the degree of a person's preference and not just the direction of it. The sizable minority with the strongest preference would be willing to buy some of the majority's votes, and the majority would be willing to sell. There's another more basic argument for allowing a market of votes. All else being equal, if one person would rather have a certain amount of dollars than their vote, and another would rather have that vote than their dollars, both people end up better off from their own perspective if you allow them to trade. But although letting dollars buy votes is theoretically elegant, in the real world, voters don't all start out with equal resources. Some are richer than others, and allowing votes to be bought and sold would just amount to letting the rich buy votes from the poor. Academics have overwhelmingly concluded that allowing a marketplace in votes would be tantamount to letting the rich disenfranchise the poor. Political philosopher Michael Sandel sums it up by saying that no one defends the outright purchase and sale of votes. I took a course called Justice with him during my freshman year at Harvard. Admirably, he didn't even discuss his own theory until the end of the semester. Sandel is famous for his argument that over the last few decades, capitalist thinking has infected and commodified other spheres of life. His big book on the topic is called What Money Can't Buy. It turns out the answer is less and less. Sandel appeals to two kinds of values in arguing about the evils of market power: fairness and corruption. The first is straightforward. The more kinds of things dollars can buy, the more wealth inequality extends to inequality in other arenas of life. The unfairness is the biggest problem with woke consumerism. When you think about it, consumer boycotts actually work the same way as shareholders electing members of a board of directors. The more shares you hold, the more of a voice you have, and the more buying power you have, the more weight your boycott holds. Boycotts can give the superficial illusion that they're a tool of mass mobilization, but they take political issues to territory that naturally favors the wealthy. If 100 liberal households boycotted Goya, for instance, to come out ahead in the exchange, it only needs one conservative who owns a restaurant chain to go on a Trump-fueled buying binge. But the boycotters won't ever know how the dollars and cents ultimately shook out. But they'll feel good. Maybe that's the real point. Inviting withholding and spending money to be a primary tool in political argument is unfair to those who have less of it, but it also corrupts what democracy is supposed to be. This is the second kind of argument that Sandel makes. Fairness aside, he says that when we allow money to determine what happens in non-capitalist spheres, like family, religion, or democracy, money inevitably corrupts those spheres and cheapens what they mean to everyone. When we use boycotts and buying sprees to determine political issues, we cheapen democracy. It doesn't just give the rich yet another advantage over the poor. It also makes those with buying power worse off too, in subtle ways they don't even recognize. It drags everyone down by making money, rather than open deliberation, the first tool of democracy. The image of citizens debating the issues of the day in the town square begins to sound like a laughable idealization, a naive fantasy, rather than the very foundation of democracy. When we use money to starve barbers we hear are racist, we're simply using raw power, the closest thing to physical violence we can legally get away with. Here's the fundamental moral mistake woke consumerism makes. When punishment is the first tool we turn to, rather than persuasion, we naturally start to see people who disagree with us as enemies, not fellow citizens. Sure, you might think it's the other way around, that we use punishment because we already think of our opponents as enemies. But I think the causation goes equally in both directions. As you turn to punish someone, you are naturally more prone to see them as your enemy than someone to whom you're committed to actually persuading. The beauty of democracy is its invitation to try and persuade the other side. The ugliness of woke consumerism is the way it replaces that invitation with a call to use brute force as punishment instead. It's a game in which all players lose, and it leaves us divided as a people in the end. All theoretical considerations aside, there's something obviously undemocratic about winning political arguments through censorship. Punishments for saying the wrong thing and associating with the wrong people are a special threat to fundamentally American rights to freedom of speech and association. These rights are the bedrock of our democracy, which is why the First Amendment protects them from federal and state governments. But the Constitution can't protect us from ourselves. Only we can do that. When the citizens are banding together to stifle free speech and association, the solution can only be found in norms, not laws. We have to choose to stop employing these oppressive tools at the drop of a hat. Maybe the left would be persuaded to stop boycotting and blacklisting its political opponents so wantonly if it just remembered that the last time blacklists were used so prominently as a political tool, the left was the target. Back in the 40s and 50s, Senator Joseph McCarthy brutalized his political enemies by framing them as communists, causing them to be blacklisted in their industries so that they'd lose their livelihoods. He didn't have to resort to reason or evidence. All he had to do was brand someone a communist, or even a communist sympathizer, and fear of association with them would do his work for him. McCarthy's favorite targets for blacklisting were government employees, entertainers, academics, and labor union activists. The blacklist was a tool for stifling the left's ideas without actually having to debate them. Now, the blacklists are back, but this time the left is the one using them. Witness how right after Biden's victory, Representative Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, "Is anyone archiving these Trump sycophants for when they try to downplay or deny their complicity in the future? I foresee decent probability of many deleted tweets, writings, photos in the future." Immediately after her call to arms, a group calling itself the Trump Accountability Project sprang up, aiming to prevent people who'd worked for or donated to Trump from gaining future employment. As an article in Politico dryly noted, these types of enemy lists are rarely a healthy sign in any democracy. The New York Post made the reference to McCarthyism explicit. A columnist wrote, "Joseph Ocasio-McCarthy, your time is now. You've got a little list." The blacklist was wrong when McCarthy used it to target leftists in the 50s, and it's wrong when AOC and her followers use it to target Trump supporters today. And it's wrong for the same reasons. This is not how a democracy is supposed to function. The target of the blacklists and boycotts doesn't matter, left or right. If speech is abhorrent, a democracy like ours is supposed to answer it with more speech, not censorship. That's one of the things that separates us from the Chinese Communist Party. Part of what it is to be an American is to reason with those who disagree with you, and to beat them at the ballot box, not to attempt to legally deprive them of food and shelter. Citizens of a liberal democracy do not attempt to dominate their political opponents. The spell of McCarthyism began to break when, in response to McCarthy's attempt to blacklist a young lawyer by branding him a communist, Joseph Welch famously asked McCarthy, "Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?" For all the valid theoretical considerations I've brought up against blacklisting and boycotting political opponents, I think Welch's way of putting it gets to the heart of things. It is unbecoming for one citizen to use the threat of starvation and homelessness to silence a fellow citizen. It lacks common decency. The Founding Fathers saw our big sort coming, as Bishop himself observes. One of their great fears was that the United States would be united in name only, that we'd sort ourselves into groups and be more loyal to those groups than to the nation itself. Whether the U.S. would descend into partisan chaos or not was one of the main debates between the Federalists, who wanted to ratify the Constitution, and the Anti-Federalists, who wanted to keep the states independent. The two sides debated each other through articles and newspapers, trying to win the public over. The main voices for the Federalists were James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. Their essays in support of the Constitution are now called the Federalist Papers, while the essays their opponents wrote are called the Anti-Federalist Papers. The Federalists won the day, so they got to write history. And as a result, today civics classes teach that James Madison's 10th Federalist Paper brilliantly proved that the Constitution would prevent our nation from descending into squabbling between parties. He made the mistake of assuming that the only problem posed by factions would come from tyranny of the majority, arguing that the Constitution's popular rule mechanisms would prevent a partisan minority from seizing power. In thinking that the problem of partisanship would come from an enduring partisan majority, Madison may have overlooked the importance of the possibility that we would have two similarly powerful factions continually striving with each other for dominance. This is the central problem of partisanship we face today. Because Republicans and Democrats are closely matched in numbers and power, neither has a stable, enduring majority, so each constantly maneuvers to gain the slightest advantage over the other. When two rival factions are closely matched in political power, they have overwhelming incentives to place their own partisan interests above the country's wherever possible. John Adams actually saw this potential problem. Unfortunately, he didn't write any Federalist Papers, or even play that large a role in drafting the Constitution. He was serving as an ambassador in London at the time. Madison knew parties would be dangerous, but didn't fully understand why. We don't need to dig into all of the details of his reasoning. Present-day experience is all we need to prove that his theoretical arguments must have missed something important. Unfortunately, this dark prediction from an Anti-Federalist paper, written under the pen name Cato, withstands the test of time better than any of the Founding Fathers' sunny assertions. But whoever seriously considers the immense extents of territory comprehended within the limits of the United States, together with the variety of its climates, productions, and commerce, the difference of extent and number of inhabitants in all, the dissimilitude of interests, morals, and politics in almost every one, will receive it as an intuitive truth that a consolidated republican form of government therein can never form a perfect union. This unkindred legislature, therefore composed of interests opposite and dissimilar in their nature, will in its exercise emphatically be like a house divided against itself. The Anti-Federalists said that we couldn't have a shared nation without a shared identity, and that we were just too big and too diverse to have a shared identity. They were even more right than they knew. In the time since then, we've gone from 13 states to 50, and the continental United States has stretched itself all the way to the West Coast. California and Alabama seem like different countries, but they live under the same federal roof. As my old law professors Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld point out, the Constitution had some great successes in its attempts to forge one people out of many. Maybe the greatest of those was its guarantee of religious freedom, which allowed all kinds of religions to coexist. Protestants and Catholics, later Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists, agnostics, and many others. Thanks to the Constitution's protections, America was able to avoid the religious wars that had torn European countries apart for centuries. And in the 14th Amendment, the Constitution gave America birthright citizenship, a unique and powerful force to guarantee